From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing.
We're in a scary dispute with North Korea and a really stupid one with Britain. The Congressional Budget Office scored the Republican health plan, and the results were ugly. And President Trump's skinny budget would spend big on the military and make big cuts to the State Department. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. Welcome, everybody. So this week scared the crap out of me. Sean Spicer did something insane at the White House press briefing on Thursday, but our news environment is so insane right now that it didn't even dawn on me how insane it was until hours later. You may recall that 2 weeks ago, President Trump was upset on a Saturday morning, and he tweeted that President Obama had illegally tapped his phones at Trump Tower during the campaign. Now, as far as we can tell, Trump just made this up, but because he can never admit he was wrong about anything, his tweets have sent the White House into a two-week frenzy of trying to justify the president's bizarre claim. So on Thursday, Spicer responded to congressional intelligence committees saying they had no reason to believe there was surveillance of Trump Tower, by quoting a story from conservative media personality Andrew Napolitano, alleging that GCHQ, a British intelligence agency, had spied on Trump at Obama's behest. So Spicer raises this accusation, and of course GCHQ hotly denies it. If it were true, it'd be a violation of at least informal agreements among the Five Eyes intelligence-sharing countries that we're not supposed to spy on each other's citizens. On Friday, the London Telegraph reported that the White House had made a formal apology to the British. But the White House is characterizing it differently. Remember, Trump doesn't apologize. So a White House official told the Washington Post that they had explained to the British that Spicer hadn't accused them of anything. He was just noting the existence of the story without endorsing it. Now, a stupid and unnecessary diplomatic incident with Britain is not going to lead to an exchange of nuclear weapons. The British are a long-standing ally, and their government, unlike ours, is run by an adult. We're going to see with Britain what we're seeing with a lot of foreign powers, which is other countries giving Trump the space to act crazy. But not every country is like Britain. You may have noticed there's a burgeoning crisis on the Korean Peninsula, where the North Koreans are testing intercontinental ballistic missiles and seem to be itching for a war. If this situation is mishandled, many, 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 many people could die. North Korea is a very hard international relations problem, and neither President Bush nor President Obama made much progress with it, but so far, we've at least avoided an actual war, even when tensions have escalated. The thing that scares the crap out of me this week is, if Trump can't even properly de-escalate this stupid fight with Britain that he created, how the hell can we expect him to de-escalate situations that are much harder and much more consequential? Am I overreacting?
I think we're in a very dangerous moment. I mean, listen, there were people who were freaked out when Donald Trump was elected because he would have his hand, finger on the nuclear button. Now, one resolution of that would have been to take nukes off of hair trigger alert. But, you know, part of this is also Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. There's no one in the State Department, essentially. They're empty boxes and people rattling around. And he's talking about military force as a way to resolve the North Korean conflict. This is madness. I think what needs to be said is that you got to get some people around Trump who understand this. We're past the hope of hoping to muddle through in North Korea, waiting for sanctions alone to do the trick or for the North Korean regime to collapse. And you need a new diplomatic initiative. Is that possible? I do think we saw with Trump, after his recklessness about a one-China policy, we saw the limits of Trump's power. When China pushed back, he became a paper tiger. That's what they said in China. So I think, I guess I'm looking at the structural piece too, Josh. I know we'll talk about it, but defunding alternatives to military force, this budget, which may not pass in full, but it's setting down a marker that this president sees military might, military force, use of military force as a way to confront the challenges of this world. I think that's archaic. I think that's wrong. I think that will lead not only to American carnage, but global carnage if that's the way they're going to proceed to defund alternatives To use a military force.
Rich, what do you make of this? Because, I mean, as Katrina notes, this budget proposes about a 30% cut in the State Department, but that sort of signals a broader sense that I get about the Trump administration, which is that they don't take diplomacy seriously. They don't think this stuff is hard and complicated. And I worry that, you know, the Korean situation, some others have basically been held together with duct tape for years, and they're not prepared for them to fall apart.
Well, I would disaggregate these two things. The wiretapping tweet, as far as we can tell, is exactly as you described. Donald Trump was lonely and angry on Saturday morning after Jeff Sessions recused himself after the latest eruption of the Russian story and just lashed out on the basis of some news reports, some of which are quite sketchy, but suggesting that there might have been FISA surveillance of people around Trump. Now, does that constitute a wiretap of Trump? No. Would it be much better if Trump would just kind of memory hole this the way he has memory holed other things in the past? You know, for the campaign when he was attacking Judge Curiel, there are a lot of people who thought, well, once Trump digs in on something, he can never let go and he'll keep on attacking this judge forever. No, he just finally realized it was stupid and self-destructive to keep attacking him, and he let it go. And they'd be very wise just to say, because as you're right, he can't apologize, just we're not going to talk about this anymore. But the problem is it's now rolling where you have Senate committees digging in and now an international incident over it. So it'd be much better if they stop it, but they haven't yet. The North Korea thing is, I think, a different animal in lots of ways, one of which is that this is not a crisis caused by the Trump administration. You know, all the readouts from Donald Trump's meetings with President Obama on the way out was President Obama said, the one thing you should be worried about, and it's going to take much more of your time than you're aware of, is North Korea. And this is an unstable, crazed regime. We have been on the precipice of war with them before. Under Bill Clinton, we actually considered a preemptive strike. The way I read what Tillerson said, it's a more robust version of what every administration says, which is that no option is off the table. The problem with a preemptive strike is you could precipitate a wider war, and Seoul would be subject to, at least at the outset of that war, fairly catastrophic shelling from the north. So this is not a road you want to go down. But eventually, I think it is going to be intolerable to us if the North Koreans actually develop ballistic missiles robust enough to carry nuclear warheads and that are accurate and long distance enough to strike the United States. We have a deterrent relationship with other countries, Russia and China, for instance. I'm not sure we want that relationship with North Korea.
You know, the interesting thing about the election was, you know, for better or worse, I think for worse, a lot of people voted for Donald Trump, even though they agreed with Hillary Clinton's assessment that he was temperamentally unfit to be president and to have his finger on the button. Nobody, you know, everybody, of course, wants him to take the North Korea threat seriously. But what is very disturbing is we see a president who is often unhinged, who says things without foundation, and then forces his advisors to essentially then defend something that is embarrassing, that is untruthful. And that in itself, to see the U.S. government all trying to organize to defend something that is indefensible, should be extremely disturbing. We're not even 2 months into the administration. But what becomes more scary is not that you have a president who uses tweets to distract, strategically distract from his political problems, but uses military threats or recklessness to distract. And I think this is where he has to take the seriousness of this job greater. He may not be happy with what's going on the Affordable Care Act or potential Russia investigations, but I think there is a real wag the dog fear about how this president is proceeding in his first 2 months, which should be of great concern to any American Democrat or Republican.
See, that's not even, I mean, I guess that is something that maybe I should be concerned about, but I'm not even concerned about him doing this purposefully. I'm concerned about him doing it by accident. I think, you know, to Rich's point, in a normal administration, I would think it makes sense. You know, you say all options are on the table. You want to deter the North Koreans. You want the North Koreans to be afraid that there are circumstances under which we would strike them. I just don't trust Donald Trump to then figure out what the right situations are for actually doing that. I think that that's a high wire act that is difficult to manage, but, and I don't think he has the capability to manage
but
it.
But Josh, administrations are made up by the people who are brought into those administrations, right? So what we're witnessing after about 53, 4 days of a Trump administration is he's centralizing the making of foreign policy and a lot else in the White House. Not unusual. Obama did that to a certain extent. But the quality of an administration is also about the quality of people brought around and how they are brought in. Tillerson, Secretary of State, is being marginalized. And the generals who were so touted about, where are they? I mean, Mattis has talked about the danger of just increasing the military budget, that you need, you know, alternatives. So I just think that it's not all about the president. But if you're going to have this kind of family-run foreign policy, which, you know, seems increasingly clear, or Breitbart foreign policy, Bannon or Jared Kushner, that is frightening as we confront some real challenges. This world is upended. You're going to have European elections. You got the North Korean threat. You got a president, as Gene said, recklessly tweeting out foreign policy. But the real danger is just that there are these roiling crises because we're living through turbulent times. We see it in this country. And I just don't think the president has a setup, has the people, has the fundamental navigational tools to move forward.
I would just, again, make a distinction. President Trump has a phone that he has control of, at least on the weekends. So he can tweet whatever he wants. If he wants a war with North Korea, he can't do that himself by pushing a button. It would require all sorts of coordination across the government. And what we've seen so far in his foreign policy is that it's been normalized. You know, he may have come in saying, I'm questioning the one China policy. But then when he actually talks to people and sees what the consequences of that are, he's like, no, actually, I'm going to accept the one China policy. We've seen the same thing with NATO. We've seen the same thing with his policy toward Russia. So I just wouldn't put what Tillerson said about North Korea in the same box as a reckless, stupid tweet on a Saturday morning.
Well, but this is my concern about the tweets, is that, you know, Trump tweeting on a Saturday with the phone he controls on the weekend seems to have real-world consequences now. It leads to 12 days later on a Thursday, Sean Spicer standing at the podium in the White House press briefing room raising the possibility that the British were in cahoots with the former president to spy on Donald Trump. So I worry about those unintended consequences. Obviously, there's no button on his Android phone that launches nuclear weapons, but I worry about him creating incidents that escalate rather than de-escalate situations and put us in a situation where those formal powers end up being used in destructive ways because path-dependently, Donald Trump has created a situation where we feel we have to do
But that. I worry less about – I do worry more about the structural problems with Donald Trump's foreign policy. I think Rich is right to a certain extent. He's been normalized. So he's now part of a kind of discredited bipartisan foreign establishment framework. I mean, Donald Trump, again, is betraying to a certain extent what he campaigned on. When it came to foreign policy, it wasn't isolationism as much as it was opposition to regime change, opposition to America policing the world. And I do think he's now back in this kind of more militaristic 19th, 20th century approach to the world. And I think that combined with his advisors, combined with his sense that he is the master of the deal, but if pushed back, he's going to push forward, that to me is frightening.
Gene, you've been in the White House. You've watched this decision-making process. How much do the institutions protect us here?
Well, in the two White Houses I've been in, you had very rigorous National Security Council processes where there was long meetings, and these are meetings where you have the top experts feeding into a deputies process that then feed into a principals process and then bring in the president of the United States. So you take things seriously, but your process by which you act takes these things seriously. So when you are communicating, whether it's right or wrong, it is well measured. We see the president get on the phone with the Australian Prime Minister, not even prepared, doesn't even seem to have read something, makes offhand comments about invading Mexico. We haven't even hit the 2-month mark. So I do think that, you know, to your point about intentional versus just not up to it, I think recklessness is what you fear a little bit, and perhaps you know, there's no sense that one is seeing the kind of deliberative process where serious professional people, evidence, all sides are heard, is feeding into a well-orchestrated presidential decision, whether you agree with it or not. And that's why I think that should be concerning, you know, regardless of what your overall foreign policy orientation is.
Well, let us know what you think about Trump and crises on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, the skinny budget. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, and Gene Sperling, who has advised Presidents Clinton and Obama on economic matters, is also with us. So last week on the show, we talked about how the impending Congressional Budget Office score of the health care bill was going to be ugly, and indeed it was. The CBO estimated that 24 million Americans more would be uninsured by 2026 if the bill were enacted than under current law. In light of the ugly score, Republican leaders in Congress have admitted the bill needs to be fixed before it can be passed, but there's a problem. Everybody seems to have a different idea of what fixing the bill means. Senator Susan Collins, for example, announced she couldn't vote for the bill because it doesn't do enough to make insurance affordable to low-income Americans who are nearing retirement age. Indeed, she said she wants a bill that covers more people than the ACA does. But you also have conservatives who think a fix entails making the bill less generous. Meanwhile, Trump released a document the White House is calling a budget, but isn't really. This so-called skinny budget makes proposals for discretionary spending, that is, programs like the military, the National Institutes of Health, the State Department, things that have to be funded every year. What it does say is quite stark. Trump wants a substantial increase in military spending and a bit more for Homeland Security, and then cuts almost everywhere else, some of which are quite deep, including cuts around a third to the State Department and the EPA. NPR listeners might also be interested to know the budget would zero out funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which helps fund public radio stations. That said, the budget is just a proposal, and many parts of it have gotten pretty cool receptions from Capitol Hill, even from Republicans. As I look at all of this with the budget and the healthcare bill, the thing I think is the broad deal between Trump and the Republican Party was basically supposed to be they would let him be weird and they would let him build his wall, and in return he would, quote, sign their bills. But it's not even looking clear to me that this Congress can even agree on what bills to send up to Trump to sign. So, Rich, what do you think the status of that agreement is?
Well, it remains to be seen. It's in peril. I think if the Obamacare repeal in place goes down, you could see a real nasty split between President Trump and Congress, because he's certainly not going to point the finger at himself for the failure of the bill. He's going to point it at Paul Ryan and others, and it'll be very difficult to do anything else legislatively in that circumstance. So that may provide a further incentive for Donald Trump to go his own way. I'll circle back to a couple things I said last week about Obamacare. We were talking about the Senate, and I was saying that the moderates in the Senate had more tactical, substantive leverage than the conservatives do. I think that's true of the House now as well. The CBO score has surfaced that a lot of moderates in the House have problems, have a problem with this bill. And my understanding is Paul Ryan is more focused now on getting them than he is on getting some of these high-profile conservatives who are on cable TV all the time. And also, we talked about a possible path to passage, and I laid one out, and I said the end game would be passing the thing through one vote when it comes back from the Senate and the House, you know, after you hold the vote open for 3 hours and engage in all sorts of procedural trickery and twist people's arms off on the floor. I now think that has to happen with this initial foray in the House. It wasn't a good sign that it only passed the budget committee with one vote. It's a sign that if this thing gets out of the House, I still expect it to, it's going to be by the skin of its teeth without a lot of momentum and going into a Senate that will completely rewrite it.
So you think he'll be able to twist enough arms? Because it feels like there are a lot of these conservatives who are quite loud about how this bill is Obamacare light and it creates a new entitlement. You think he'll be able to convince all but, you know, what is it, 19 of these conservatives that they should vote for this and move it far enough to the left to bring basically all the moderates on to vote for it?
I think he'll make the subsidies more generous further down the income scale to try to get the coverage numbers up, and maybe the SOP to the conservatives will be something that looks like more flexibility for the states on Medicaid. But it's just it's pretty easy to pass bills out of the House in the scheme of things. This one's going to be really hard, but the House is kind of a tyranny, and I'd be very shocked, and it'll be a debacle if they can't even get it out of the House. So I think the odds are better than even that they get it out of the House, sending it on to a very uncertain future in the Senate.
Gene, as you look at this budget proposal that's come out from the White House, how seriously should we take this budget? Is this likely to be anywhere close to reflected in law?
Well, it's so extreme. It's so severe. And when you put it on top of what we're seeing on the healthcare side, which is that Republicans have essentially perhaps benefited politically on attacking Obamacare, but it's been somewhat the true big lie, which is that somehow a bill that has ended people being denied coverage of pre-existing conditions because they have a child with a disability or a spouse with a heart condition and covered 21.5 million more of our fellow citizens and neighbors is somehow a catastrophe. And, you know, I think you start to see now that they have to try to fix it themselves and realize that everybody has to do measures like either refundable tax credits or some penalties if you want to have a stable pool and have a stable health care. You know, you're going to start to see messages bleed from the health care into the budget, which is that this is a plan that is going to be very bad for working Americans, for everyone, for working middle class, for the working poor. And, you know, consider, for example, in the same period of time, you're hearing that older Americans are double losers under the Republican health care plan, meaning they can now, by law, be charged 66.7% more. And yet they're going to get less of a subsidy, so that the Congressional Budget Office puts out an example of an older American, I mean, someone from 55 to 64, making $26,000 a year, and now under the Republican plan, having to pay $14,000 for health care. At the same time, they're reading that Meals on Wheels is going to be ended, for which serves 500,000 veterans, that after school care, which helps so many parents, have working parents, have something educational for their kids to do, is going to be completely eliminated, over $1 billion. Weather assistance that affects all kinds of working families when they are facing higher energy costs, eliminated. I think that the overall message of this is going to be quite devastating, and I think that they will not get this full budget. But I think this budget does great harm, Rich, and here's how. The discretion, the budget for all the things that so many people care about, cancer research, NIH, education, training for nurses, all of these things is in what's called the domestic discretionary budget. It was already at virtually the lowest levels in over 50 years. It was already a bare bones budget. Now they are trying to cut $50 billion from it, and they're already acknowledging $6 billion from NIH, $3 billion from Pell Grants, the eliminations we've talked about. So I don't think it will be accepted, but what I fear is that people will say, oh, it was going to be a 30% cut in the budget, and now it's a 15%, it's more moderate, when it will still be a 15% cut from the things that most affect working families, or 15% cut from what was already a historically low level. And I think you'll see real people being hurt throughout our country.
I was going to say, when I look at both the budget and the health care plan laid out, I think of the great betrayal because, as Gene said, I mean, the white working class voters in red and purple states who gave Trump the presidency, his most loyal base, this will ravage their communities, their health care. It will eviscerate Medicaid. And let's not forget, there's often a sense of the other with Medicaid, but I believe it provides 60% of long-term assistance for the elderly in nursing homes. I think the Democrats have to lay out their alternative. I think that's vital.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I want to talk a little bit about healthcare freedom. This has been a rubric that some conservative critics of the repeal and replace bill have been making, and what it effectively means, since we're not going to achieve a libertarian paradise in healthcare, it means we're going to subsidize the poor through Medicaid. We're going to subsidize the elderly through Medicare. We're going to subsidize employment plans through the tax system. And the only people who will experience this healthcare freedom under this view are the working poor who make too much to be in Medicaid, but not enough to afford their healthcare plan. They will get freedom. Congratulations and enjoy.
Gene Sperling.
Well, my rant will also relate to Medicaid and to what Katrina said, which is that it is appalling to me that people, that the Republicans would try to use Medicaid as like a piggy bank to help fund their tax cuts for the most well-off. And that's exactly what's happening. We should be affected by the fact that 30 million poor children do rely on Medicaid. But as Katrina said, this is also the program that helps families across our country when they become medically needy because they have a child with a disabilities or when their parent has to go into a nursing home. And I think that this will be, you know, we are seeing that despite the effort to try to suggest that it's okay to cut some programs because they're for poor people, that's wrong morally, but it's going to end up being wrong factually in Medicaid and program after program as people realize this is my parent or uncle who's gone to a nursing home. This is my cousin who has autism, and they are being hurt not out of any shared sacrifice for fiscal discipline, but simply to support a budget that is designed to increase defense spending substantially and to provide tax cuts for the most well-off Americans who do not need them.
Katrina VandenHeuvel.
So the president's first federal budget proposal seeks to eliminate all federal funding for public broadcasting, zeroing out allocation to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Trump's actually attacking the stations that serve many parts of the country that supported him last November. We're not talking about Washington, New York, or Santa Monica. We love Santa Monica. We're talking about like Prairie Public Radio, which broadcasts along the North Dakota border with Canada. Of the 575 public TV and public radio stations across the U.S. that receive CPB grants, 248 of them serve rural regions of the country. So I think we need to enlist our rural allies, our friends, and fight hard because with all the talk of fake news, public media offers real, documented, needed news for communities around this country and not just in the great coastal areas.
I'd note also those rural stations tend to depend on the CPB for a larger fraction of their budget. They
absolutely
don't have the fundraising basis that New York and
Santa Monica
et cetera, stations have. With that, I'm going to forego my rant. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina VandenHeuvel, and Gene Sperling. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Berskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.